We only started to have week one reactions for us. It's always fun after week one to, you know, try and buy in early to some things we think are happening, try and ignore some noise on things we don't think are going to sustain and happen. I have no better guest to do that than Mr. Stealing Signals himself, Ben Gretsch. Before I throw it to Ben, do want to let people know about a promotion we have with Prize Picks. If you haven't played on Prize Picks, it's a really easy site to basically do prop betting. You can parlay props. You have to pick at least two. The lines are kind of soft, so it's something that we've been taking advantage of. If you sign up and use promo code ETR, you get a 100% deposit instant bonus match up to your first $100. So if you deposit $100, you get $100 immediately in your account as a bonus that you can use to play on their site. So definitely check that out. We've also got a Prize Picks comparison tool to our projections up on Establish the Run. But without further ado, Ben Gretsch from bengretsch.substack.com. Thanks for joining me, Ben. And I know you had a lengthy Stealing Signals week one. As always, it was a great read to kind of try and digest all the things we saw happen week one. And there were a lot of those things.
Yeah, there was a ton. I was joking with you before the show. Whenever I do these early season shows, people are like, what are the biggest signals or the biggest noise or the biggest notes you found? And I'm like, man, like everything was important. You know what I mean? Like that was the first little bit of info we got. We talk, you know, when we did our projection series in the offseason, we talk about probabilities, thinking probabilistically, ranges of outcomes, right? Like there are upside cases for players, downside cases. We just got our first like actual usage notes, how players are going to be deployed, all of those things. At the same time, I think week one is probably the least important week in terms of, I mean, it's obviously the most important in a ton of regards. We want to be reactive right away. But in terms of being reflective of the rest of the season, I don't know if there's you've probably done research on that. But it feels to me in week one, in past years, and certainly this year with certain teams, that there's teams that are kind of just like, okay, the things that we came out trying didn't work. Let's pack it in. They're not in their flow yet, right? It seemed like a couple teams kind of gave up. Atlanta was one. We're going to talk about them. Green Bay certainly got just sort of ran out of the game. They only ran 17 first half plays, and then a couple Rodgers third quarter picks, and they brought in Jordan Love really early in the fourth, and they're like, all right, we're not winning this game. The game was a blowout at that point, but they're like, we're done. We'll go focus on week two. You know, this is a loss. And maybe they would have done that midseason as well, but I just think once you get going, once you have sort of questions and answers about like how teams are going to play you on defense and how you want to respond, then teams maybe are going to be more willing to do things that are more, I guess, predictive of what they want to do, or you know what I mean.
Like their identity hasn't been established.
Right. Week one's a little weird in that regard for certain teams. So it's really fun to try to sift through all what was signal, what was noise in week one, what was real and is going to continue to be real, what won't. There's a lot of stuff from last year, week one. Were you commenting on that somewhere that like it did not continue, right? There was a lot of stuff that looked great in week one last year that did not happen the rest of the year.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a mixed bag, which is why it's important to kind of do what you're doing and try and parse the signal from the noise. And like you said, there's a lot of variance. I mean, you just saw it in just the football score results with Green Bay, for example, like just getting blown out. Like that's not something we'd expect to continue, and nor should we expect that to continue. I think there's just some variance. Like you said, the teams don't know how the other teams are going to play them, and there's no tape, and there's just a bit more variance there. Where I do think there's some signal, like last year we got Myles Gaskin right away week one.
Yep.
And we could buy into that. Again, just thinking probabilistically, there's also some team level stuff that I think is important. And it was kind of funny when I was talking to you about show notes for this pod, I told you I wanted to keep it a little bit tight. And then I listed about 30 things for us to talk about. Because there are so many, but I do think like there are a few teams that jump out to me and that can kind of expand to individuals. And one of them is the Chargers stuff, which was, I thought, really good for them. They ran a ton of plays. And I know I was a little worried about some of the Herbert stuff coming into the year for fantasy. Just they ran a lot of plays last year, and just with a new coach, I didn't know what that pace would be like. So to run a lot of plays against Washington, I think was really good. Obviously some of that had to do with Washington's struggles offensively, but that was good. The pass rate over expectation was high. That was really good. And then for individuals, there was some good stuff. as far as Mike Williams and Austin Eckler's usage.
Yeah, Williams and Eckler were two of the big kind of signals for me this week in my article. Eckler gets the early goal line carry or green zone carry, which I always call the green zone, inside the 10 carry, however you want to refer to it. I believe it was a 3-yard or 4-yard touchdown run. But then the key thing for me was like, yeah, we saw Larry Roundtree operating as a number two. That wasn't really a clear situation either. We had heard a lot of positive stuff about Justin Jackson, who to me looked more like the Eckler backup. Roundtree's this, more early down plotter to Eckler's more, you know, pass catching or secondary role. But so it was very positive to see Eckler get that touch inside the green zone early. That was a big part of his profile. Can he get those touchdowns? The bigger thing was later throughout the game, he got all three of their additional running back green zone rush attempts, and they were all on different drives. Four different drives, Eckler was the one to get the carry inside the 10. And so that was a pretty big one. We don't get usually that much evidence in one game, immediately when he gets the early touch, you're like, okay, at least he's going to get some touches here. He's certainly not going to come off the field for someone else to be the goal line back. But by the end of the game, I'm like, it looks like Roundtree's the guy that they don't necessarily trust in close. They want to just go with their best back in close, which some coaches do. You know, they're like, these are the most important touches. We need to get the ball in the end zone. And so it does kind of look like Eckler's going to have some decent touchdown potential. The flip side, doesn't catch any passes. He did run a good amount of routes, probably not as many as last year or as many as we'd like to see. But I do think some targets will come, but that was rough. Mike Williams, to your point, he gets 12 targets right away. Gets him at a lower A dot, gets the end zone look from the 3-yard line. Like they're, you know, showing us they want to use his big body down close. He gets the TD there. Basically everything that was in the upside scenario for Mike Williams. I mean, I've talked in the offseason, I had some concerns about him because his targets per out run has been pretty stable for 4 straight years and not good enough to really be a high target guy. But there's a clear opportunity behind Keenan Allen now, no Hunter Henry and all these things. So the fact that he comes out, gets 12 targets right away, immediately has a strong week one targets per out run, gets it at lower depths, because that's been the big reason he hasn't earned so many targets. It's all downfield stuff for him in the past. And then also gets, you know, the red zone look that we want. For him, he checked every box in week one. It's like, man, this guy could have been from here on, I feel like he's like a 4th, 5th round pick, you know?
Yeah, I was definitely light on Mike Williams, kind of the same reasoning as you. You know, I'm real picky about the upside case on guys that I'm unsure if they can earn the targets. I'm always beating up on Henry Ruggs in this regard. Like, I just don't know if he can do it. And the same thing with Mike Williams. You said for years he hasn't done it. And yet I find myself very quickly adjusting, like doing our DFS projections. I think it's one of those scenarios where like the ADOT like kind of shows that it wasn't just like fluky funneling like extra targets that just happens throughout the game, that there was probably something real there, that he was being used in a legitimately different way. But still, you know, it could regress, but I'm pretty bullish on Mike Williams moving forward. You mentioned the green zone touches for Eckler are great to see. I'm more excited about that than I am worried about the pass catching, just because we've seen the pass catching from him for so many years. And it's not like they were using another back in that spot. They just didn't have running back targets this week, which, you know, just sometimes that happens.
Right. It could be a matchup, whatever. We saw a lot last year with Eckler splits with Herbert. He got a ton of targets from her. I mean, I know it's a new coaching staff, still same quarterback. You know, there are elements to this where maybe week one will be a signal that his receiving won't be as strong this year, but I don't think it's going to be horrible. Right.
Yeah. One of the teams that crushed me in DFS week one was the Falcons. They came out of the gate with 2 drives that stalled like inside the 5-yard line, kicked 2 field goals. I thought they're absolutely going to smash. And then they did not, you know, they stalled out on those 6 points. Matt Ryan averaged 4.7 yards per attempt. They were atrocious. Their pass rate over expectation was one of the lowest in the league. They were extremely run heavy relative to game script, which definitely a concern for me, because I had thought, given their personnel and basically the way they seem to have signaled things with how they've approached the running back position, that was saying, hey, we're just going to throw the ball a ton. Yeah. So that's concerning, especially with Arthur Smith coming from a place where they did run heavy. It was easy to say like it was personnel reasons why he ran heavy in Tennessee and not Atlanta. But week one, we get this data point that they're maybe not going to throw as much as we hoped. The flip side, Ben, is if Matt Ryan was efficient at all. Like, we got the usage we wanted out of Mike Davis. We got the usage we wanted out of Kyle Pitts. You know, you put it in your stealing signals. I believe it was 8 targets, you know, 4 catches, 31 yards. You ran, you know, route on 79% of dropbacks. Like, that's great. That's a really good sign.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, that looks fantastic for his potential long-term. We did also see sort of, you know, nobody wanted to be the guy that was down on Pitts. Pitts looks like he's going to be absolutely elite. But one thing that happens even with elite players is, like, especially the efficiency right away. I mean, like, you go back and look at even, like, the Calvin Johnson, elite receivers, Calvin Johnson, Julio Jones, some of these guys that were, and similarly physically imposing like Kyle Pitts, they were good as rookies. They scored touchdowns, but they weren't, like, efficient in, like, a catch rate sense. There's going to be some plays where they're not on the same page with their quarterback, maybe not running the right route. Like, he's still a rookie, you know what I mean? So we saw the usage. I think there is, like, some mild efficiency concerns with Kyle Pitts. Still have to be very, very excited about what we saw overall in terms of his usage. To your point about the way that they handled the running back position over the offseason, I mean, I was – on the exact same page as you. And then to see them come out in an I formation and run Cordarrelle Patterson in the first half, I was like, so everything they did with the running backs was not because they did care about the running backs. It was because they think Cordarrelle Patterson at age 30 is now an I form up the middle running back, which that individual play to me was like the most shocking one for Atlanta. It was like the microcosm of Atlanta's game. It was like, what are you?
The play for me,
I'm completely wrong.
Yeah, the play for me was like early. Mike Davis ran for 40 yards in the first quarter, I think, and Patterson was ripping off 7 yards run. So I was kind of like, all right, this isn't what I hoped to see, but it's working. Then it stopped working, and they got behind. And there was a play where they ran the ball on like either a second and third and very long. And then ended up having to go for like a 4th and 12 after they ran for like 3 yards and an obvious passing situation before. And that's when I was like, what, you know, did they give up? Like, this is only a 2-score game. Like, what's going on? So we'll see what they do moving forward. They play Tampa Bay week 2. Kind of interested from DFS where like nobody's going to play them. I'm not going to play Matt Ryan, but like, I think it's going to be concentrated and maybe we see them against, you know, Dallas just came out and said, like, we can't run against this team. We'll have to throw. Maybe Atlanta does that again, and then you just kind of cross your fingers. Matt Ryan is a little bit more efficient, and the ball does seem like it's going to go to the right guys, the guys that you want. So another team along the same vein, Ben, where I was a little worried about the play calling because it was the exact opposite of what I expected, but we got an exact opposite result in terms of efficiency was Cincinnati. They were very low in pass rate over expectation. And
by your numbers,
I think, right? They were last. Yeah. According to the NFL Fast R numbers that I aggregated. And part of it, like someone said, Burrow maybe got like, I don't want to say banged up, but like tweaked something a little bit late and they went real conservative after that. They were also running all over Minnesota. But at the same time, even the pass plays they called were somewhat of a different nature than last year. You know, a lot less empty sets, a lot more play action, which is good from an efficiency standpoint. But like, I did think this team was going to throw a ton. I thought they were going to run at a fast pace, and they did neither of those things. And it's easy to ignore it because they were so efficient and the fantasy results were there. I was pumped with Jamar Chase's usage, you know, comes right out of the gate, leads the team in snaps and targets. You know, T. Higgins did leave the game for like a few plays for an IV or something, but you know, clearly Chase was going to play basically every passing down. So that was great, but yeah, a little concerned about, you know, what the pass rate looks moving forward. And you know, maybe it gets better as they get a little less concerned about Burrow's health, or maybe they're just going to be not as exciting as we thought.
Yeah. I mean, that's one where my expectation was that they would be more run heavy in week 1 than where they settle in, because we knew Burrow kind of had a up and down August in terms of, you know, the comfort level and all those things. I mean, that's what I was expecting them to be, again, more run heavy than wherever they're going to settle. Now, what I wasn't expecting was them to start at the very bottom in terms of run heaviness. So to your point, it's like, now it's obvious they're probably going to be more pass heavy than that as we go forward. But where they settle now feels like it has, you know, average or below average in that range of outcomes. I thought maybe they would be like fairly balanced and then eventually settle as, you know, on the pass heavy side. Your great notes from the offseason we talked about in our podcast series was that in every single game last year that Joe Burrow started, they were a positive pass rate over expectation team.
And they ran more plays than league average every single week.
And that's not what we saw in League One.
They ran 68 plays, which is more than average, but they played a full overtime period.
They played a full overtime. And especially the pass rate was not what we saw in Week One. They were very, very run heavy, to your point. I do think that's going to shift over time. It'll be interesting to see how long that sort of takes. I think it might take a couple of games. But the flip side of that is, like, Joe Burrow, to your point, was efficient. He looked really good, actually. Jamar Chase looked good. Higgins, not even necessarily being 100%, looked great. They barely even had to get Tyler Boyd really involved because Chase and Higgins were basically, you know, balling. Both of them had over 10 yards per target and you know, not a ton of volume, but doing very well with the opportunities they were getting. And so you have this sort of other side of it where when they start throwing more, I'm going to be very excited to be on the off. And I mean, I'm just probably going to play some DFS lineups with the Bengals this week and almost every week until we see the pass rate explode, because I do still think there's so much upside in this pass game.
And the Rams just had a lot of success passing over expectation versus the Bears, who the Bengals play week two. So we'll see what happens there. But yeah, I'm super pumped for the Chase start. That's just what I needed. I think he's one of my highest exposure players in season long. So I was really stoked about that. Also stoked about Dallas. You know, a lot of good signs with Dallas. First off, we see them willing to pass at a really high rate, you know, especially over expectation. I think they were the top team in pass rate over expectation. I had mentioned last year they threw a ton because they got in these hugely negative game scripts and they run at a really fast pace. But in some ways, their pass attempts were misleading, where they weren't crazy pass heavy relative to expectation last year. They just had a high expectation and ran a ton of plays. Week one, we see them run a ton of plays and have a really high pass rate over expectation. I know in Stealing Signals, you noted that there were some called run plays that Dak actually checked to a pass, which makes sense given the matchup against a really stout Tampa Bay Buccaneers defensive line. They're really good against the run, but overall still really good. We saw the condensed target share that we were hoping we saw, because they really weren't as crazily condensed as you might think last year. And then the Gallup injury stinks, of course, but you know, that was part of the reason why you draft those three guys, is if any one of them gets hurt, the other two, you know, increase. So I was pretty happy with the Dallas stuff, and just Dak looking completely healthy was a really big deal, both the shoulder and the ankle.
Completely opposite approach from Cincinnati, right? Like I sort of expected Dallas to have the training wheels on Dak a little bit, at least in the first half, and just sort of feel out that game a little bit. It was the opener. We didn't really know about the shoulder, especially. And then the leg is just another one. And they came out and were like, no, if he's playing, we're going to throw the ball everywhere, you know, especially in the matchup. Like you said, the note that I had in Signals, I was kind of just comparing them to Tampa and being like, which of these is, you know, more likely to come back to earth a little bit, because Tampa threw a ton too. I think Tampa's the team in this game, and I'm still very, very optimistic about Dallas, but Tampa's the one that just looks like the team that could throw constantly. They have unguardable pass weapons, right? Like, they didn't even need Mike Evans, but like between Godwin and Antonio Brown and Gronk, they're going to have a matchup win somewhere. And Brady is your quarterback. He's going to find that matchup win. And their running backs were so bad that like they might just go full Bills.
I actually have Tampa Bay in terms of my pass rate over expectation in my model that kind of weights recent games a little bit more and picks up. The highest team I have baseline is Kansas City at 10.3% over expectation. Tied for second, Tampa Bay and Buffalo at 8.3%. So
they're already full Buffalo.
And what's different from them from Buffalo is like Brady's not going to scramble. Like, I'm counting scrambles as pass play. Brady's not going to scramble. Brady doesn't throw the ball away. So like those opportunities go to somebody. So that you're right. That is exciting for them.
The Thursday night game, it feels like it was so long ago now, but it was a big one for both those offenses.
Yeah, and some good notes from players on both sides. With Tampa Bay, you noted some Mike Evans concern in your column. I'm a little worried as well, just because I think Godwin's role is stable, just because it's a little bit more of a move to change type role. And then Antonio Brown, I think last year was third in targets per out run, you know, among a certain threshold. And we saw the same thing week one, where, you know, he didn't play as many snaps as Evans, but his targets were there. So I'm not like out on Evans. I actually think he's an interesting, you know, just play the bounce back guys in week two. But there's some concern that he's just going to be really volatile, I think, throughout the year.
Yeah. He'll have big games for sure.
Yeah. And the running backs will be volatile too. Ronald Jones, if you've got guts, is a fun as hell DFS play week two. You really got to have some guts for it. But if you do, he's going to have some weeks, I mean, I think, still where he's.
You're a glutton for punishment. I don't think there's anyone else who would describe the Ronald Jones experience as fun as hell. But
so, if you've got guts, man, we're going for 102 this week.
I want to hate myself on Sunday. So he's a fun as hell play.
Hey, come on, man.
No, I mean,
Pat's like, listening right now.
The ceiling is the roof with Ronald Jones any week, man. Like he can definitely have a 20 carry game. Fournette didn't look good. I think I was tweeting during the game that the Ronald Jones Fournette thing, it's so funny. It's the biggest battle, like low key, the most like people get really fired up with their tweets about it. The biggest battle, everyone has a side. They're either a Fournette or a Rojo guy. I've always been a Rojo guy. And the only thing that I think we have really gotten is that they both just keep like tripping over their dicks as soon as the other one does. Like one, Ronald Jones fumbles, Leonard Fournette volleyball sets a dump off to the defense for an interception one play later, or one drive later. Like, I mean, they have to match each other for fucking up.
So one thing that I do want to get your take on, the Giovanni Bernard usage was way less than I thought it was going to be. He like seemed like he was basically the same role that it was last year, you know.
I didn't like that
different.
Yeah, I didn't like it. He had the injury, and we don't know how serious it was. It was originally called a high ankle sprain. I didn't think, you know, originally when we heard about it, it was like, okay, he's going to miss some weeks in the season. So it was a little bizarre that he even was ready to go for the Thursday opener. I'm telling myself, you know, two things on Bernard to explain to myself why I'm not cutting him in season long leagues, and I want to at least roster him for a little while longer. One, you know, Jones got benched right away and Fournette didn't look explosive. Like I know all the Fournette truthers got to have their victory lap because he got all the touches, but like the dude caught five passes, had like 12 PPR points. Congrats.
Does he ever look like, did he look explosive when he was churning out 20 points a game in the playoffs last year?
Come on,
does he? I was just saying it.
Don't say something logical. I mean, come on, man. this is the Rojo Fournette debate you were talking about. And then two with Bernard is that he may have been hurt still. Like, not maybe his role was smaller because he wasn't fully healthy. So those are the things I'm thinking there.
Dallas side, before, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but we do go back and forth on Amari Cooper stuff. And this is me reading your article, Stealing Signals, like just knowing your take heading into the season. And I really felt like you were making a point to state that you still prefer CeeDee Lamb to Amari Cooper. And I don't get why you can't just accept that they're just both smashes. Like, do we really need to delineate between the two? They're both going to smash.
I mean, the point that I've made since the offseason is that Cooper could be just an absolute superstar and, excuse me, Lamb. Freudian slip there. But
I'll let you. Sorry, go ahead, and then I'll.
Well, and Cooper, I've always been really high on him, and I might be a little biased, like against the fact that like back in the day, I was taking him. I remember I took him second overall in a dynasty startup once over like superstars, right? Like I'm like, Amari Cooper's going to be the best wide receiver in the NFL. He had that prospect profile. He started off amazing, and so maybe I'm just knocking him because he's just been sort of good. But the guy's never had a 250 point PPR season, which is not very strong for a ceiling. And some of that's due to injuries and things. Some of it's just due to like inconsistency that I think consistency is way, way overrated. But like we do have enough consistency now in terms of his season long lines to be like to question whether he has a true ceiling. Right. Lamb could be DeAndre Hopkins is the example that gets brought out a lot. Right. Like he can be a guy, could be a superstar. His targets per out run last year were actually better than Amari Cooper's. he didn't actually run a full slate of routes in week one, which was a little bit disheartening. But then at the same time, Gallup gets injured. And I think what was happening is a little bit on some of the two tight end stuff they're doing. They're playing Gallup and Cooper and not Lamb, because Cooper was out there for everything. But I think we'll see Lamb in those two wide receiver sets going forward. So that was part of what I was saying about the sound signals. His targets per out run was again better than Cooper's. Again, didn't have full routes. Now he's going to actually maybe get those full routes, you know? So, and then Cooper, yeah. Some of his work was second half after Gallup went down, low A dot, short completions, and very consistent, like rock solid, getting wide open for like 8 yard gains over and over. But Lamb was the one that looked like he was like earning big targets, if you know, I mean, down more down the field targets. He had the drops issues, but man, I still like, I genuinely watched that game. I think the drops are almost so unimportant.
I'm not worried about the drops.
Yeah, I'm like counting them as stats is how unimportant I think they are. So that's part of it too. I'm like, Lamb could have had this good of a game. You know, he had this many on target balls delivered. So anyway.
My Cooper take is that I understand we haven't seen that huge high-end fantasy ceiling yet, but like one, we were going to see it last year. Like undoubtedly, if Dak doesn't get hurt, his targets, this huge target game he had week one kind of lines up with all the huge target games he had before Dak got hurt last year. He's someone that was like one of the best wide receiver prospects we've ever seen. And he's been very good at the NFL level. So, yeah. And he's in his peak. Like, I guess the thing for me, like he's in his peak, right? Like 27 years old, like that's wide receiver peak years. So, I feel like we're treating him like, you know, like this is Jefferson Thielen.
Every time I talk to you about him, I'm like, I'm too low on him. I mean, you do sway me, but at the same time, like,
I like
it's so hard with the year two breakout receivers. You definitely like it's easy to undervalue how big those breakouts can be. I will say with the point that Cooper's never had a 250 point season. I'm trying to pull it up right now, but like that's a little bit of a unfair thing because in 2019
he's gone over 1,000 yards. In
right,
you know, six so or had, 7 years.
He had 246 in 2019. He had 235 last year. He also had a 227 season in his second year. He had a 220 season in his year that he came over to Dallas midseason. And he was better. You know, he was pacing at the end of that season for like, there's definitely points where he's paced for better than this. And he's had multiple times where he's been close to 250. It wouldn't be that crazy to see some of that like pacing stuff actually extend to a broader, you know, a full season line 1 year, and he just puts up a 300 point season. It wouldn't be that crazy.
The other thing with the year two breakout, like that's a huge plus in Lamb's favor, but I don't think like it's a knock against Cooper. Like Cooper hasn't played in an offense like this for a full season. So it's almost like we're saying like, oh, Lamb has this big ceiling because he's a year two breakout. Well, it's like, well, Cooper could, and now that he's in this offense that he's never been in before, other than the first five games when he crushed last year, like he could break out too. You know what I mean? Like, but yeah, that was
you're
just
right a about little, that. I mean, yeah, he's
diatribe.
Your point about his prime age, like, God, I went and looked it up. He just turned 27. Like somebody,
I know we young 27.
We do this with all of the young receivers that came in the league really young, but like, he just turned 27. This dude feels like he's been in the league for a decade. I mean, he almost has been. He came in the league in 2015, but he was a young 21-year-old that year. He turned 21 in the summer before, you know, right before the season started. He still probably has some juice and some ceiling.
But yeah, it's wheels up for both of them. I mean, they're going to see like 50% target share combined in a team that runs a bunch of plays with a really efficient quarterback, and they're both really like, it's great. I think one team that has a couple of stud receivers as well is Tennessee, and they really struggled week one. I couldn't believe I was counting money in a Tannehill double stack that started off hot. I had like a 1% Debo in it, and I was counting my money because I was like, oh, Tennessee in this game script in the second half is like, this is what we want. And then Chandler Jones just sacked Ryan Tannehill play after play. So we had Arthur Smith goes from Tennessee to Atlanta, and Atlanta crashes and burns. Julio goes from Atlanta to Tennessee, and they crash and burn. I'm not panicking on this one. Games like this happen. They just didn't really happen for Tennessee a lot last year. Like they just ran super pure last year, and they had a game this year where they didn't run pure. Like I don't know if there's too much more to it than that or what your takeaway is there.
Yeah, I mean, they were down double digits from the 8-minute mark of the first quarter on. They never got within double digits. And so people were talking about their their play action pass rate cratering. I mean, it's not good that they didn't still try play action, because we know it still kind of works. Even if you haven't established the run, it's worth still throwing in there. At the same time, a new offensive coordinator, new play caller in his first game behind, you can understand, like, that's one possible reason why they were not running as much play action as last year. Like, or put differently, because they might not be at last year's rate. We were already kind of expecting they might come down a little, but why they weren't even like why week one might not be indicative of what their play action pass rate will be for the season. And we want to see them do that. That's where Tannehill was very efficient. That was really helpful for his career resurgence, was the play action stuff. Week one could have just been a thing where they're like, they're behind, and they feel like, because they haven't established the run yet, they can't call enough. They can't be calling constant play actions. It was a weird game. I completely agree with you. You have to question a little bit of their offensive line. You also have to question a little bit, is Arizona's D going to be decent? Like,
I was wondering that too.
I mean, they added J.J. Watt in the middle. Is that why? Like, Chandler Jones is the one who wrecked the game, but, like, did that help Chandler free him up a little bit? Like, you know, what happened there? I don't know the X's. I'll be excited to read Thorne's article about, you know, to check on those teams for sure, the Tennessee O-line and the Arizona D-line, because I thought that was a really interesting thing, the way that Arizona's D-line wrecked that game, and whether or not Arizona's D might just be sort of legit.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. So those were like the major team situations I wanted to talk about. I think we'll close it out like just kind of quick hitting on some specific individuals whose stuff was, you know, optimistic week one, and whether you believe in it or not. One guy I have to give a shout out to, because I'm so hard on him, but, you know, Derek Carr going downfield against the Baltimore defense. You know, should I be readjusting my priors on them, on Vegas in general, who I really expected to regress out of the top 10 in yards per game, out of the top 10 in points per game? They looked the part week one.
Carr was really interesting to me, because the first half I was like, man, I mean, I got a little bit more on him this year, talking to Sean Siegel, especially on my Stealing Bananas pod. He's mentioned that Carr's kind of made these small steps forward, and it made me kind of rethink that maybe I've just been stuck too much. Because I've definitely thought that in prior years, that he's, especially in 2020 and in 2019, that he's been looking a little better. The first half, I was actually pretty disheartened. Some of the downfield shots to Darren Waller looked like he was just forcing into sort of bad coverage. We saw some of the stuff where he's just like chucking up balls, like downfield and to the boundary, like he used to do with Amari a ton, where it's like, you're throwing a really difficult pass here. The boundary's like, you know, an extra defender. You're basically putting this somewhere where the completion percentage is very, very low. He was making some throws, some reads, and then just absolutely locking onto Waller, which is like good for Waller's fantasy value, but not even incorporating the receivers. And then to your point, you get into the explosive fourth quarter and overtime period, and suddenly he's seeming to adjust plays at the line and finding, I mean, he threw that deep over route a couple different times. He hit Ruggs on it once, and then he hit Zay Jones on the game winner, where he's actually getting a guy coming across the field out of a bunch formation. He seems to like that throw. I mean, that was one that worked well for him twice, but he's starting to hit the receiver, starting to hit Bryan Edwards on deep, you know, in routes and mixing up his pass targets to different guys. It was a really like Jekyll and Hyde performance for me in the first half and the second half, where in the second half, he actually was like finding the open dude, throwing different types of passes, not just like throwing to Waller, regardless of if Waller's running up the seam and there's a safety bearing down on him and he's got to drop it in over, you know, a trailing linebacker. And like that, some of those were just like poor decisions. You had to be super precise, and he's probably not precise enough. And then, yeah, anyway, to your point, late in the game, some of the stuff with like Bryan Edwards over the middle to get him in a field goal range on that last drive, he just hits him twice on two really, you know, well-timed in-breaking routes, gets up there, spikes it, like calm as hell, you know? So we saw some good, we saw some bad, sort of what was my response.
Yeah. My biggest takeaway is I do feel silly having Waller and Kittle right next to one another. And immediately, I mean, it's a long season. We got a long way to go, but it's like, oh yeah, Waller's still getting every single target, and Kittle still has a really low floor for, you know, a top three round player, just because San Francisco can score the way that they do. Speaking of tight ends, David Njoku runs more routes than Austin Hooper. He's had a really strong profile for a while. It's like one of these guys we've been hanging our hat on. Is he going to break out? We didn't think it was going to happen. Really was kind of excited for him to move on from Cleveland. And then he ends up staying in Cleveland. And now has this great week one where he goes 3 for 76 off of 5 targets. I believe his air yards were really high for a tight end. I'm not sure what the final number was. That's fun. I'm going to be looking at him in a really soft matchup week two. I don't think Cleveland's going to throw a lot against Houston, but he's someone that, like, in all formats, you got to keep your eye on.
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Like, he's definitely someone who has the profile you got to keep your eye on. You want to be excited about. At the same time, you know, Cleveland was more pass heavy against Kansas City than they might be in some of these other matchups. And if he ran the most tight end routes, that was big, because last year it was like Hooper most, and then him and Harrison Bryant next to each other. He's clearly separated from Harrison Bryant, and even over Austin Hooper, that's different, right? That's a note. At the same time, he's still not running like a number one tight end's worth of routes. They are still using Hooper, and they still mixed in Harrison Bryant. So there's another way to look at it where, like, if we're anchoring to last year, we're saying it's a massive improvement. There's an opportunity. But if we're just looking at what he did, and we're looking at Cleveland probably not being as aggressive as they were against Kansas City in most any other game, that was a really tricky one for me. Like, I think he's definitely worth stashing in some deep, like, tight end premium leagues and just seeing what happens. And then the other part of it is, like, didn't he request a trade this offseason? Part of me was thinking, like, they were just, like, trying to – like, I'll be interested to see if he runs the most routes again this week, or if they were just trying to, like, come out week one and be like, look, you're a part of our team. We care about you. You know what I mean? Yeah. You see some of that stuff. I just, it'll be really interesting, because he could be really good if he can continue to have a high rap share.
And that is where, you know, doing the DFS projections, like, I still have Austin Hooper for more targets this week than Njoku, despite Njoku running more routes. And it's tough to balance those things. It's a guessing game for sure. Let's end the note on some running back stuff. So Daryl Henderson, DeAndre Swift, Jonathan Taylor, Najee Harris, I think all had some pretty optimistic week ones for different reasons. For Henderson, it was just that he controlled the backfield snaps. You know, is Sony Michel going to take more of a share as the year goes on? I mean, probably, but to what extent? With DeAndre Swift, it was just, I mean, it was a fluky game, but the fact that he got more carries than Jamal Williams when we were worried about his health coming into week one and got a ton of the targets was great.
And we saw the explosiveness from just, you know, the film grinder take. We saw that all last year. He looks like he's the most explosive back in the NFL. I mean, or right up there. He looks really good at football. That matters a little bit.
Yeah. And then JT was like, we saw the running back targets that we were worried would disappear with Phillip Rivers gone. And then Najee playing 100% of snaps. So those four guys, kind of, I guess, like, what do you buy and what do you sell in there?
I like them all. I mean, I think you got to buy all those positive notes. The Henderson thing was huge. The, you know, Swift getting the high value targets, or the high value touches, getting the targets, getting the, you know, he had a long touchdown, but that was his profile last year. Got a lot of green zone touches. I don't remember if they even ran a ton of plays in the green zone, or who was getting him, or Williams was getting in touches in close. But I was very encouraged by Swift's role. Basically, I mean, just you want explosiveness in fantasy. You want guys that can do Jamal Charles type things, and he looks like he can do that with regularity, and guys that catch passes, and guys that have TD equity. He's got all of it. It seems like, even though his role isn't necessarily as big as you want, he can still be like an absolute monster. Taylor, I was very encouraged, not just by Taylor's receptions, but also Hines had them. Just the fact that they were willing to throw the backs a lot. It won't stay, the running back target rate won't stay that high, but it was encouraging. They lost Phillip Rivers. He throws to the backs a lot. We saw that they're going to continue to throw to the backs. Like, that might be something they worked on a lot with Wentz. I don't know, but definitely encouraging that they, you know, to see Taylor used in that way. And who was the last one you said? Harris. Zero. 100% snap share is great.
Yeah, I was going to say zero Marlon Mack snaps was also.
Right, you know, right. Yeah, just two backs in the backfield. I noted that signals. Philadelphia was another place where I didn't expect just two backs in the backfield. Those were two big ones where it's like, okay, the third guy didn't even play an offensive snap. That's notable.
Yeah, Najee was the bull case and the bear case hitting at the same time in a weird way. You know, he plays 100% of the snaps, but does absolutely nothing with it. And I think we'll see better we're going to see better results from him going forward. He's an interesting one because I'll tell you right now, but like, he's going to be the chalkiest running back week two in NFL DFS. I'm looking at the market projections early in the week. there's no doubt he's going to be the chalkiest running back. So he's an interesting one to kind of
He's going to be so hard to figure out too, because we now know that for sure, and we already kind of knew though, that the workload's going to be massive. The question is the efficiency, right? Like you can fail as chalk with 15 points because you caught five passes and didn't have a ton of, you know, like big runs and you didn't score. And Ben Roethlisberger's arm looked terrible. Like their offense might just suck. Like that's part of why you got to be on Harris, because they look like they can't throw down the field. Like, I don't know what that was awful, but man, that'll be interesting.
Yeah. All right. Before we sign off, you know, I know there's so much you go through each week. Your mind's probably a blur, but if there's anything else we didn't hit that you just thought was particularly interesting or notable week one? If not, you know, that's cool too. I think we went through a lot of useful stuff.
Hockenson along with Swift was huge. I mean, 7 of his 10 targets in the first half. They only threw 20 times in the first half. They wound up throwing 31 passes just in the fourth quarter, and they were, you know, playing against a different defense and everything. I like to look at when teams are playing it straight up, and they were targeting Hockenson. It was almost like the Darren Waller game. Like they were targeting Hockenson, it seemed like every time Goff dropped back, not quite as much, but 35% target share in the first half of that game was pretty notable. I'm kind of looking through. Oh, James Robinson was an interesting one. His role looked like what we thought Travis Etienne would do, right? Like this sort of Alvin Kamara role to the Mark Ingram back in the Saints days, like how they would play together. And then Hyde was in the what we thought Robinson would be. Like they had Robinson out running routes downfield. That was one of my big signals of this week as well. So yeah,
I was kind of stunned. We saw, I think it was 198 DJ Chark air yards. Obviously some flukiness with how often they threw, but just all the negativity around him in camp for him to come out week one and put up that number.
That was big.
It was a good sign if you're sitting. I'm sitting on some DJ Chark shares from early in the offseason where I definitely took him too early. So I at least feel a little bit better about that
now. I got one more DJ for you for our bet. Me and you have a bet, $1 per point, Amari versus DJ Moore. Look, Christian McCaffrey looked as amazing as ever, and that's not great for DJ Moore, but I will say the fact that they used him on a jet motion tip pass, the fact that they gave him a rush attempt, he still was getting downfield targets. They put him back to run a punt return, which almost made me pull my hair out because you don't want to see DJ Moore get hurt on a punt return. But we know that shows up on some prospect profile stuff where in college, just the fact that guys are getting put back there is typically evident that they think that that guy's one of their better players. They want to get the ball in his hands. They think he's a playmaker. That was the concern with Moore. Whether the coaching staff might in the offseason go back and not change his role, because last year it was like, hey, we're just going to have you run downfield. Or they might go back. The positive case was they might go back and say, we got to get the ball in this guy's hands more. The fact that they gave him a jet motion tip pass, a rush attempt, even the punt return, to me is evidence that they were like, look, DJ Moore is one of our best players, if not our best non-Christian McCaffrey weapon in the offense. We need to get the ball in his hands, both short, downfield, all of those things. That was big for me. Tough matchup for him in week two. He's going to probably potentially draw shadow coverage from Lattimore, right? But because they got the Saints this week, I think.
Yes. It's a tough matchup in general, too. Just
The
Saints could slog it out. We saw them shut down the Packers. But yeah, DJ is going to be really good. And just
I'm trailing you in that bet, but I'm mildly optimistic it won't be too bad.
Just like Amari, though, he's got the offense where, like, if anybody goes down around him, like, he's gonna, you know, benefit from that. The issue, of course, is you took the guy playing with Sam Darnold, and I took the guy playing with Dak Prescott, who's gonna run 70 plays a game. Those contextual differences.
I'm gonna need some. I'll admit I'm the dog here. I'm already trailing. I already owe you money on this bet.
Yeah, Cooper did spot me about 20 points a week one. So, yeah. But. Ben, tell the people where they can find Stealing Signals, which is released every week and pretty much a must read.
Yeah, bengresh.substack.com, Mondays and Tuesdays, break down every game in sort of like a recap fashion. I'm basically just going through my analysis process, looking at all the big usage notes and everything, and then I recap every game with the signals and the noise for that game. At the end of part two on Tuesday, I do my biggest signals and biggest noise for the week. So there's a lot of people who just like to get those quick nuggets. It's a really long article. I mean, I don't know how people read it, but I do try to summarize it there for the people that want the quick stuff. It is a premium newsletter. It's $8 a month to subscribe. So that's where you can find that podcast, Stealing Bananas with Sean Siegel over at RotoViz Radio, and Ship Chasing on Wednesday nights with Pat and Pete, sometimes with Leone. He pops in every now and then.
When I haven't fallen asleep yet.
Yeah.
normal man, even though I don't have the West Coast time that you have. Okay, I'm over here on the East Coast. Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
All right, thanks so much for joining me. And a reminder again, if you want to play on Prize Picks, it's a ton of fun. It's a really good way to take advantage of, I think, the really sharp projections at ETR to line them up with Prize Picks and make your parlay picks over there. So use promo code ETR, get that instant $100 bonus, immediate bonus, which is nice. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We shall see you next week.